my name is Michael McCusker. I might have a packed show this morning, as it turns out. So I'd like to start with a letter that I have just written to the Daily Astorian, which may or may not print it. And I guess I should probably say that this is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only in the entire cosmos. A habitual letter writer to the Daily Astorian, known for his virulent intemperance, has attacked John F., which in his mockery stands for fraud, Kerry, in his latest tirade. I prefer the writer remain anonymous because he relishes attention, perhaps under the delusion it repudiates his dreadfully intolerant opinions. Kerry replaces Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State in the renewed Obama administration, which has spurred the writer's slanderous attack. He claims that Kerry has, quote, been continually exposed over the years as a liar and a fraud, unquote, which he also claims, quote, emanated from his abbreviated tour of military duty in Vietnam, unquote. I wish he would verify all the lies that Kerry is supposed to have told. I question his own veracity. He has called Kerry a traitor several times in previous letters, simply because he was a member of Vietnam Veterans Against the War after his return from the war, in which he received a Silver Star and 3 Purple Hearts that were the basis for what the writer dismisses as his abbreviated service in Vietnam. Many Americans had shortened combat tours in Vietnam because they were either killed, seriously wounded, or, like Kerry, wounded even lightly multiple times. Kerry testified before Congress in 1971 and spoke clearly and honestly about the virtual genocide of Vietnamese. Thousands of Vietnam veterans have corroborated his testimony. Despite its claims of superpower exceptionalism, the United States should eventually be prosecuted at the World Court for its criminal abuses in Vietnam and for the similar annihilation of civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan. These policies of indiscriminate body count, and that's a quote, are from the highest levels of American policy, and refuse to acknowledge this truth is to betray every humane principle this country claims to be founded upon. The letter writer's personal smear campaign of Kerry goes back 2 presidential election cycles, when Kerry campaigned against George W. Bush in 2004. The GOP smear machine was in full vigor. The phrase, swift voting, came out of the attempt to deceitfully defeat Kerry during his run at the presidency. He served aboard Navy swift boats in Vietnam and has become a political euphemism for describing similar shams to defame an opponent. The intemperate local scribe espoused and repeated every slanderous falsehood about Kerry while rabidly denouncing any criticism of his hero, Bush. Yet Bush was the actual fraud. He used his privileged position of inherited wealth to not only evade service in Vietnam, he was also a deserter for having disappeared from his Silk Purse National Guard unit for a year during the war. And as president, which I suspect history will eventually acknowledge was fraudulently attained, Bush reacted contemptibly and erroneously to the 9/11 terrorist attack, having ignored warning such an attack was imminent, by fabricating the reasons for the U.S. invasion of Iraq 10 years ago. He brazenly proclaimed himself as America's war president and publicly postured in a make-believe military uniform in the manner of a comic book despot. Although Bush claimed he was God's chosen leader of America, he was certainly not elected by the American people the first time, and most likely not the second time either. Our illiberal slur-slinger relentlessly shrieked traitor at everyone who dissented against Bush's presidency. Yet since the election of Barack Obama, he has done little else but vilify the, quote, affirmative action president, unquote, his term. He employs scarcely disguised racial slurs against Obama in his letters. His little trick is to turn the racism around upon whoever calls him on it, and implicitly accuses him of betrayal as a socialist and non-citizen ineligible for the presidency. In his most recent rant, he claims that Obama has, quote, brought the country to an ultimate low, unquote. This is not merely dissent, but an act of willful amnesia. His Republican idols and their avaricious patrons brought on the current nationwide misery and have obstructed every attempt to remedy it. Perhaps their self-proclaimed intent to destroy Obama's presidency rather than repair the financial smash-up of the country might be measured a genuinely definitive act of treachery. He rebukes the majority of the electorate that voted Obama into his second term rather than his preferred slate of right-wing demagogues for being, quote, the gullible, the greedy, and the ignorant. That description more readily fits him and his hypocritical ilk. And I signed the letter as former Oregon coordinator of Vietnam Veterans Against the War, which you might say is my stake in the argument. Well, last week I read some items from New Yorkers that a friend of mine left on my porch. And I'd like to continue in the talk of the town because I just bought one. And here is an article by Jeffrey Toobin, The People's Choice. Before Harry Blackmun became a federal judge and then a Supreme Court justice, he was the general counsel at the Mayo Clinic, the celebrated medical center in Minnesota. There he developed a reverence for doctors, which was reflected in his judicial opinions, especially in Roe versus Wade. In that decision, which was handed down 40 years ago this week, the court ruled that states must allow a woman to obtain an abortion during the first trimester of a pregnancy. According to Blackmun's majority opinion, the ruling fell under the right to privacy that is implicit in the Constitution. In keeping with his predilection for his former colleagues, he emphasized the rights not of women, but of doctors. Quote, the attending physician in consultation with his patient is free to determine, without regulation by the state, that, in his or her medical judgment, the patient's pregnancy should be terminated, unquote. The word physician appears in Roe versus Wade 48 times, the word woman 44 times. As the court returned to the subject of abortion in subsequent decades, the rationale for its decisions shifted. In the 1992 case of Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the court reaffirmed Roe in an opinion written jointly by Sandra Day O'Connor, Anthony Kennedy, and David Souter. That decision focused on the provision of the 14th Amendment, which says that no state shall, quote, deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, unquote. The justices said that a woman's decision to terminate a pregnancy was within the realm of personal liberty which the government may not enter. And that's a quote. More recently, in a dissenting opinion, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, joined by three other justices, offered still another constitutional justification for a woman's right to choose under a different part of the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Clause. Undue restrictions on the right to abortion, Ginsburg wrote, violate a woman's autonomy to determine her life's course and thus to enjoy equal citizenship stature. This sort of evolution is not unusual in the history of the Supreme Court. Some justices like to assert or pretend that the Constitution has a single meaning and that each case thus has only one correct resolution. This view is especially pronounced among conservatives, who in recent years have claimed that they can identify the original intent of the framers and use their 18th century wisdom to resolve any modern controversy. But of course, interpretations of the Constitution have changed over time. Legal theories pass in and out of fashion, and most important, presidents can and do change the understanding of the Constitution by naming new justices to the bench. There have been 12 since 1973. That is the real lesson of abortion rights in the Supreme Court. Politicians, especially presidents, lead. Judges, even justices, follow. Ronald Reagan nominally opposed abortion rights, but he never invested much energy in the cause. Two of his appointees, William Rehnquist as Chief Justice and Antonin Scalia, opposed Roe. Two, O'Connor and Kennedy, supported it. George H.W. Bush had a similar record, one appointee against Roe, Clarence Thomas, and one in favor, Souter. Roe has survived since then because Democratic presidential candidates have understood that they needed to support abortion rights in order to win their party's nomination, and the four current Democratic appointees on the court, Ginsburg, Stephen Breyer, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan, have voted and will vote accordingly. These four, plus Kennedy, assure Roe's survival for now. What has changed since 1973? And even since the presidencies of Reagan and Bush won, is that opposition to Roe has become a core value of the Republican Party. To win the Republican nomination in 2012, Mitt Romney, the formerly pro-choice governor of Massachusetts, conducted a demeaning about-face on abortion. He had no choice. Lip service isn't good enough for the party faithful now. They want justices, and they would have got them if Romney had won and seats had become vacant. It is tempting to be outraged by the close correlation between the outcome of presidential elections and the outcome of cases before the Supreme Court. Aren't justices supposed to be independent of politics? Isn't that one reason they have life tenure? Aren't judges different from politicians? Not really, and that's nobody's fault. When it comes to interpreting the majestic generalities of the Constitution, there is no such thing as apolitical decision-making. So, in a time of great polarization between the parties, Democratic and Republican judicial appointees see the world and the law in very different ways. It's true that justices do surprise and exceptions do happen, but not often. That goes for more than just abortion. This term, the Supreme Court has before it major cases on affirmative action and gay rights. The difference between the current political status of these two causes suggests how the justices may resolve them. In a case involving the University of Texas, the justices are weighing the future of racial preference in college admissions. Like Ronald Reagan on the anti-abortion cause, Barack Obama offers dutiful, if not nominal, support for affirmative action. Certainly, he has not invested much political capital in the traditional civil rights agenda, nor have many other national Democratic figures. The fight for racial preferences has little of the moral grandeur and none of the political appeal of the early civil rights fights. The Democrats' apathy, combined with the energetic hostility of the political and legal establishment of the Republican Party, appears likely to doom affirmative action in Texas and perhaps everywhere else. The cause of gay rights, in contrast, is ascendant, with the president now its outspoken champion. This is the essential backdrop to the court's consideration of the constitutionality of the Defense of Marriage Act and California's Proposition 8. As it happens, Justice Kennedy is a strong supporter of both gay rights and states' rights, positions that offer promising auguries about how he will vote on DOMA. The law forbids, and the federal government to recognize, the same-sex marriages even in states where they are legal. The prospects for the Prop 8 case, which could give rise to a constitutional right to marriage equality, are cloudier. The justices have several procedural options that would allow them to duck a straight up or down vote. But there is no question that prospects for gay rights in the Supreme Court are considerably better than they were just a few years ago. That's not because the Constitution has been changed, but because the people and the president they elected have. On the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, it is worthwhile to celebrate a landmark of what is, in the truest sense, women's liberation. But it's important to remember, too, that it wasn't the Supreme Court justices alone who made sure that Roe survived. The judicial texts have evolved from odes to doctors to paeans to liberty and to defenses of equality. But it is the voters and the president they elect who will decide whether abortion rights survive for the next four decades. And that was Jeffrey Toobin in the January 28th, 2013 New Yorker magazine. I would like to read now something out of Orion from the March-April 2012 issue. It's called The Great Undwelling, How the Wealth of the Few Spells Eviction for the Rest. There are many ways to foreclose the future. And it's by the way, it's by Jay Griffiths. There are many ways to foreclose the future. Here's one, the intergenerational mortgage, a relatively new lending practice in the United Kingdom and an image for our times. Described as the debt that never dies, the idea is that the children take over the mortgage after the death of their parents. The dead hand of the past, the invisible hand of the market in an economic afterlife, holds the child's head underwater until the debt is paid. For young people in Britain and the States, the future is being foreclosed through unaffordable house prices, the introduction of steep student loans, an economy that privileges a wealthy minority, and back, behind all of these, the terrible foreclosure of the world's climate. "We have no future," was a frequent statement given by the predominantly young people taking part in the UK's street riots in the summer of 2011, unable to see how they will live, how they will dwell in all the senses of the word. To dwell well is to be who we truly are, to know a place that shelters the best of our humanity, a place from which to see the future with tranquility. So intrinsic is dwelling to the human condition that philosopher Martin Heidegger drew parallels. As the root of the German verb to be is cognate with to dwell, so a human being is a human dwelling. The old High German word meaning to dwell, Wohnen, also means to cherish and protect what surrounds you, your environment, in other words. In Heidegger's analysis, dwelling involves caring for the fourfold earth, the divine, other humans, and sky. The house as a dwelling place for the body, the earth. Education as a dwelling place for the mind, the divine. The economy as a dwelling place for the other 99% of humanity. The climate as a dwelling place for all, like the unknowable sky. Now, as the intergenerational mortgage is applied in all categories, forcing the children to take on huge debts, young people are demanding their rights to every kind of dwelling. Through the student protests of 2010 against loans, the youth riots of 2011, the climate change protests, and most recently the Occupy movement. This well-named movement took its protest to Chase Bank, which itself occupies a leading position in foreclosures in the United States and is under investigation for allegedly fraudulent foreclosures. What is happening to the younger generation as a whole is a fraudulent foreclosure. It is unfair and oddly unnatural. A reversal of the normal flow of things according to which the older generation bestows many forms of dwelling on the younger. Education is a home for the thinking mind, which can, in its formative years, dwell on, and that's a quote, a subject to be studied, and universities can give young minds their early dwelling, a first home of adulthood. The UK riots took place in areas where the younger generation was less educated and poorer than average. The government's decision to withdraw grants, which had previously enabled poor 16 and 17-year-olds to attend school or college, was also given as a reason for the fury on the streets. Every society and every generation has housed its intellectual heritage by educating its children, so they become dwelling places for its technologies, crafts, laws, stories, and philosophies. No tribe except ours demands that its children go into a polite form of bonded labor for the privilege. Meanwhile, high house prices tie people into mortgages and loans, together with the debts of crippling interest payments, and the media, amazingly, informs us repeatedly that our indebtedness is good news as house prices rise. It is not good news for anyone suffering the effects of indebtedness. It is not good news for the younger generation who may never be able to afford a home. Drowning in debt, we say, submerged in it, trying to get one's head above water, hoping to stay afloat. These water images are appropriate metaphors for personal debt and the intergenerational mortgage of climate change as the sea levels rise. Eviction is at the heart of it. As individuals are evicted from their houses due to debts, climate change threatens an eviction from the sheltering sky, an undwelling from the deepest possible sense of home. The wrong things are being sheltered, and the wrong things are being evicted. The wrong things are living, and the wrong things are dying. The coral world is thousands of years old, a gossamery, spiny, feathery, fiddle-headed phantasmagoria of shuttlecocks, foxgloves, parachutes, mosaics, frozen reindeer horns, elephant's ears, and the pawns of an underwater chess set. But while banks are bailed out and the wealthy few are well sheltered, the Great Barrier Reef will soon die due to climate change if we don't take significant action within the next 10 years. This news, shared with me in an email, was written with utter heartbreak. "I feel as if a friend is dying," the writer said. The effects of climate change, debt, like all debt, include depression, anxiety, a sense of powerlessness, stress, fear of the future, and at worst, suicide. So destructive is the idea of debt interest that for 1,500 years in the West, it was banned. The powers that were, located in the Christian church, opposed it, citing Exodus, in which lending money at interest is outlawed. In the Middle Ages, the Catholic Church vigorously opposed bankers' loans. Psalm 15 asks, "Yahweh, who can find a home in your tent? Who can dwell on your holy mountain?" The answer, "Whoever asks no interest on loans." Today, the Occupy protesters in London put up tents for temporary dwelling at St. Paul's, finding an ancient refuge there as a canon of the church, interviewed on the mountain of steps at the cathedral, defended their right to protest. When it looked possible that force would be used to evict the protesters, both the canon and the dean of St. Paul's resigned. If there is a way to avoid another Great Depression, it is to reduce private debt dramatically and jubilantly, declaring a jubilee, the Old Testament idea that every 50 years all debts are canceled. For, according to one of the few economists who predicted the 2008 financial crash, Steve Keen, a crucial cause of both the Great Depression and the 2008 crash was high levels of private debt relative to GDP. It's the oikonomy, stupid. Economy at its root has to do with oikos, home. This ancient Greek word is also at the root of ecology. While all we human being dwellings want is a home for the body, a home for the mind, and a home for the world's ecology, what we find is that the one thing well housed is the wealth of the 1%, not us, and all the other ideas of home are lost for its sake. The younger generations are being turned into exiles, denied their dwelling in the future, and they dramatize their exodus in the summer riots. Asked to underwrite a debt to the climate that they did not incur, the young predominate in climate change activism. Students, priced out of the dwelling that shelters the mind, are in revolt against their debts. And the Occupy movement, disgusted at the abuses of capitalism, put their tents on the mountain, dwelling in protest against the great undwelling. And it is the great undwelling, how the wealth of the few spells eviction for the rest, and was written by Jay Griffiths, who is the author of Wild, An Elemental Journey. And this appeared in the Orion magazine, March, April, 2012. In other words, the previous springtime. And now I'd like to read something I wrote again. Burning Bumblebee. And my disclaimer still holds. The Elmore Bumblebee canopy was destroyed by fire in January 1993. That was 20 years ago. It was one of Astoria's two most famous fish canneries that were in fierce competition with each other for nearly a century. The other cannery was Union Cannery, which was torn down a few years earlier. Thursday, 28 January 1993. I am drinking brandy in the Ship Inn, looking out through a large window at the desolation and smoking ruins of the Elmore Bumblebee Cannery. I came up here to Astoria my first season as an albacore tuna fisherman on an old California fish boat and unloaded at Elmore. 15 years later, I spent the first couple of years I lived in Astoria spelunking through Elmore and Union Canneries, both of which were important icons in the city's history, each closed and abandoned when I prowled through their immense dark spaces, now each destroyed. Union by Wreckers, and Elmore by accidental or premeditated conflagration. My partner in most excursion was Paula Bukala, third-generation Finn, whose grandparents worked in both canneries. We explored Union before its demolition, and while it was being taken apart, we rummaged through records left to blow away with the rubble and found some of her grandmother's paycheck duplicates from the 1930s. My most vivid memory of the two canneries is the large, beautiful, polished wood floor in the Elmore's cafeteria, which was built atop the main cannery building, its walls solid with windows that made the floor glow in even dull light and presented a good view of the Columbia River, though a friend who once worked on the Elmore fish line said that all anyone could see were cannery roofs crowded with shrieking, hungry seagulls. Paula and I walked, climbed, and crawled through all spaces remotely accessible in both canneries. Old machinery remained silently in place, cookers, cutting tables, ancient exotic slabs of metal whose purpose I had no idea about. More than once, police were called, but none caught us trespassing. I took another friend, Rita Rupp, into the Elmore one afternoon so that she could have a good photo when a large square-rigged Japanese naval training ship sailed downriver from Portland. We stood on the outermost pier, and while she clicked her shutter as the ship slowly passed the city, I bowed in formal Japanese fashion to the crew, who waved and shouted in true Yankee style. As we left, we saw a portly policeman who had obviously been sent to capture us trespassing, but he was too large to squeeze through the narrow window opening in a door that I am no longer capable of slithering through, but which then was my usual entrance into the cannery. Once inside, I opened a side door for Paula and that day for Rita. Rita and I linked arms and brazenly danced past the suspicious cop as if we were actors in a musical. I never worked in a cannery. My only experience was walking through when a fish boat I worked aboard was unloading. The noise and busyness involved in transposing full-bodied fish into steam-cooked little round cans impressed me greatly, which added a poignancy to my visits to the silent, abandoned Astoria canneries, often in late afternoon, when long shafts of rosy light filtered through rows of dirt-stained, dusty western windows and for brief moments illuminated unmoving relics of a dead past. I heard voices and smelled rank odors of fish and sweat mingled with grease and oil each time I visited Union and Elmore, my imagination mosaicked by snapshots of old photos of people in aprons and scarves working on the fish line in the late 19th century and most of the first 7 decades of the 20th century. I found a photograph at the Columbia River Maritime Museum of an albacore tuna boat I later worked aboard after another capsized and sank in the Columbia River Bar. The boat was tied up to the Elmore with two other fish boats when the Astoria Bridge was still under construction, Pelican, in the early 1960s, with the yet uncompleted bridge arcing high above it in the background. The records of Elmore, owned by the Columbia River Packers Association, which was bought out by Bumblebee Seafoods in the 1950s, are preserved by the Maritime Museum, which spent 2 years cataloging them for archives. The records of Union, owned and operated by fishermen and cannery workers, were left to rot or blow away, though a few scavengers like Paula and me saved scraps. But instead of preserving them for history in organized files, they are scattered among personal memorabilia. Rain falls on the grotesque bones of Elmore, which from my comfortable chair by a barside window resemble a war-blasted ship pointing out into the river. Smoke from a dozen hot spots rises into restless wisps of fog that briefly obscure the ruins every few minutes, and I wish the cannery would be whole and unburned each time the mist contracts. People whose association with Elmore is more substantive than mine visit the ruin and stand in little knots oblivious of the rain. Almost everyone I have talked with since yesterday's fire mention it and seem to feel that a tangible part of Astoria's history is lost. For many, the loss is also personal. Earlier parts of their lives as fisher people aboard boats or on the slime line gone up in smoke. I ask for a second brandy. Wendy Wolf brings it to my table. She looks out the window. They could have done something to fix it up, she says. Maybe made a museum out of it. I think of a remark by Michael Knabb, my first boss at the Maritime Museum, when I made the same complaint about the obliteration of an old flour mill on the Astoria port docks. You can't save everything, he said. And so you can't. And this has been Michael McCusker. I will be back next Thursday if the sky doesn't fall or I get scorched by a drone.